Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief of Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a closer look at some of the mysteries surrounding a couple of things we do every day: eating and drinking. There's so many mysteries related to what we eat and drink.
Right. I mean, well, when you think about eating and drinking, you know, there's nutrition, there's taste, there's digestion, there are the cultural traditions around food, there's history and agriculture and genetic modification and artificial selection. And so many interesting things to talk about. And of course, people have been eating and drinking for a long time, and there is even fossil evidence of ancient diets.
Scientists have found butchered bones in caves telling us what animals ancient humans were eating.
Right. So by looking at animal bones that are found in caves where they've also found human remains, or they found signs that people were living, they can look at the bones and they can see cut marks that show that people were butchering these animals and eating them.
And they can look at the, you know, if there's any of the remains of pottery that they would have eaten or drank out of. They can analyze for traces of lipids that might hint at, you know, the milk and the cheeses in the ancient diets.
Right. Even if the pottery was just used for storage, if it was something that held, you know, something that had some kind of a fat in it, then they can see if that was a container that was used for food. And so that's actually one of the ways that they were able to trace the migration of cheese when ancient peoples were following their migratory paths out of Africa and spreading out through Asia. There was actually a study that came out last year where scientists were able to find traces of lipids that told them that people were
in pottery
that told them that people were bringing cheese with them when they traveled.
One of the more interesting places they look for evidence is in tooth plaque.
Ah, yes, yeah. So people,
if they weren't flossing.
They probably weren't flossing or brushing very carefully. And so in the plaque of ancient teeth, scientists have been able to do chemical analysis and find traces of what people were eating. And in fact, very recently, there was a discovery of tiny particles of bananas that were found in plaque deposits on teeth that were 3,000 years old. So 3,000 years old, people were eating bananas and they didn't brush their teeth afterwards. And now scientists are examining that plaque and finding their banana traces.
And probably not surprisingly, they found that beer brewing goes back as far as 13,000 years ago. And that date is based on a discovery of actual beer-making mortars, and that was in a cave in Israel.
Right. And even fast food is something that has been around longer than you would think. It was actually a thing in ancient Rome, in Pompeii. So one of
Do we mean by fast food?
Well, fast food, you know, just food that's prepared food. So something that you you buy it and you put it in your face. You don't have to do anything special to prepare it. So one of the great things about Pompeii, I mean, you know, it wasn't great for the people because they all died in this horrible volcanic eruption, but it's great for archaeologists,
right?
Because so much of daily life in Pompeii was preserved. And one of the things that they found was a sign from an ancient eatery called a thermopolium. And so this was a stand that served beverages and hot prepared food. And I think there was even like an illustration of a saucy mermaid to try and get people to come, you know, to come over and
to the diner
and test their wares. Yeah.
But over time, modern industrial processes have led to like good and bad things, you know, that have affected our foods. And
right. I mean, they've streamlined the process. They've made food more widely available, but they've also introduced some new challenges.
Exactly. And one of those challenges is, you know, food safety, finding having bacteria or pathogens growing, living in various foods. And one of those that has been an issue in recent years is romaine lettuce.
And
you've probably heard, you know, stop eating romaine lettuce for various amounts of time.
Because of E. coli.
Exactly.
Right. And there have been similar E. coli scares recently about ground beef. And this is just largely due to the fact that that food is being mass produced at a scale that makes it really, really difficult to have the kind of oversight that you need to have to make sure that at every stage of the process that food is not being contaminated. And the reason that romaine lettuce is so problematic is because that's something that's eaten raw. So
exactly. And washing it will not, it's not most likely not going to wash all of that bacteria off is what we found.
Right. So something like ground beef, even, you know, after it goes through all of the, you know, all of the checks at the production and distribution stage, then most people, after they bring it home, they're not going to just, you know, eat it raw by the fistful. They're going to cook it. But romaine lettuce is something that's typically eaten raw. And so that's why that recent outbreaks of that have been so dangerous.
And another recent outbreak happened in tuna. And this was a really kind of a weird phenomenon. It happened in 16 states in the fall of 2019. And
right.
This was a histamine or some allergy reaction.
It's called Scombroid fish poisoning. And this happens when people eat a fish that's contaminated with excess histamine. So histamine is a natural compound that causes allergy-like symptoms. And the contamination happens when certain types of fish aren't properly refrigerated and bacteria break down the fish's flesh. And when they do that, it produces histamine in very high levels that can be toxic.
And the people who were eating it were having, you know, tingling in their mouths. I think it can cause swelling of your tongue and mouth.
Right. And then another example was something else that happened in recent years where in bagged salad, there were items in the salad that should not have been there, like frogs and toads and snakes.
I don't know if I would ever eat salad again if I had gotten one of those bags.
And even bats. There was even one bat. So what had happened was researchers did a comprehensive look of bagged salad purchases across 20 states just to see how common this was. And they looked at reports of animals that were found in whole animals or in parts, and the incidences were more common than anyone would like, basically finding any dead animal in your salad is, I think, just one too many.
And there are pictures that we have on Life Science, the article that Mindy wrote on this.
We do, yes, I did write about it, and there was a photo of a bag of salad that was found in a supermarket in 2012 with a frog in it, and the frog actually at the time was still alive. Yeah, so that's it's one of the hazards of the industrialized process that we have of producing food at this very large scale is that there is the opportunity for sometimes things to slip through that should not be slipping through.
But for today's eating and drinking mysteries, we're not going to talk about frogs and salads. We're going to tempt you with science that is delicious, a little spicy, and maybe provide some food for thought.
There's a tasty treat that is very popular in the U.S. and in many places around the world. You can eat it any time of the day or night. They're cheap, they're filling, and they're delicious. Whether you dip them in ketchup or mayonnaise or vinegar or peanut sauce or melted cheese, you probably know what I'm talking about. They are French fries. What is your favorite French fry?
I love French fries. And I'd have to say my favorite are French fries that you get on the boardwalk with Old Bay on them and you dip them in vinegar.
Those are fantastic. I have to say, I'm partial to the curly seasoned fries.
Oh, I like those too.
Those are really tasty.
They're so crunchy.
Oh yeah. And my husband is Dutch, so he has a particular affinity for French fries with mayonnaise. And in fact, he gets very irritated when we go out and we get French fries in the U.S. because most places don't automatically give you mayonnaise. In the Netherlands they do. You order French fries, you are getting mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise?
Yeah, just regular mayonnaise. Well, then there are also special dipping sauces that are mayonnaise. You have to ask for mayonnaise, and he finds that very irksome.
So the French fries I don't like are the steak cut fries. I find they're too dry. Eating a whole potato or something.
I'm not a fan of those either. They're always mealy because they're just like these slabs. Yeah, so they don't have that right. You know, French fry flavor.
But there's a lot of variety of French fries.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And they're so popular that you can get them in sandwiches, like a Chip Buddy, which actually has French fries in the sandwich. And there are California burritos. They stuff French fries into the burritos. So, yeah. So there and then, of course, there's, you know, Nathan's in Coney Island with the pump cheese. That's, you know, those are.
Love the cheese fries.
Oh, yeah. That's the best. But one thing all of these have in common, they're delicious when they're hot. And then when they're cold, they just lose all their magic.
And it's like I think it's something that everyone can relate to. When you get fries, you want to eat them right away because you know.
That's when they're best.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this brings us to our first mystery. why do French fries taste so terrible when they're cold?
So partly, foods just taste better when they're warmer. Warm, or foods that are supposed to be warm, they taste better just because they're supposed to be warm and you're used to tasting them, right?
Right. Actually, studies have found that in foods like that, heat will heighten their flavors. So there was a study that was published in the journal Chemosensory Perception, and it showed that higher temperature influenced the taste of acidic and sour flavors, that they were more intense when in a solution. Those flavors were more intense when the solution was warm, and the flavor intensity lasted longer in a warm solution than it did in a cold one.
And that's the same. I mean, I think that's a similar thing in coffee. When coffee is hot, it tastes good. As coffee cools down, unless it's, you know, iced coffee, it starts to lose the quality that makes it taste so good. And I think there was a study about showing why this happened.
Right. It has to do with it, with the heat releasing these aromatic compounds. And in French fries, this is clearly true. As soon as French fries start to cool off, then some of their flavor starts to go away. And fries are already kind of bland to begin with. I mean, you know, unless you're talking about seasoned fries, and that's why they usually come with so many things to dip them in.
Right, and why they're salted, and you know, you taste the oil and the salt.
So because fries are already a little bit bland, so once they start to cool down, then they start losing what little native flavor they did have. Then they just taste even blander.
So what about smell? What about these aromatic compounds?
Well, the smell of French fries. I mean, French fries smell incredible. So, and when you smell delicious food, it's because the food, it releases tiny particles that are called odorants. And so heating food energizes and vaporizes molecules, and that releases them into the air where they, you know, find their way into your nose. And so, and that's, you know, that's what's happening when you're smelling something delicious. But when the food cools off, the smell kind of dissipates. And so without that great smell, fries are just not as appealing.
But the biggest thing that you probably notice when your fries cool off is they sort of change, you know, they look different. They change their texture.
They look different. They feel different in your mouth. And this is the biggest reason why cold French fries are just nasty, is because when the temperature changes, French fries texture actually changes. And
how does that happen? Or what is changing the texture of? What's happening inside of the French fries?
This is potato chemistry 101. So potatoes are full of starch. And starches taste good when they're hydrated. So when there's water in them. Starches in potatoes are like these tiny little crystal spheres. So at really high temperatures, like when they're in oil or in an air fryer, then water enters into the spheres and inflates them. So it kind of changes them from these small hard spheres into something sort of poofy. So that's what gives a French fry, like a good French fry, this sort of lofty flavor. It's the poofiness
of
these structures.
So when they cool, that water doesn't stay in these little spheres or these little pillows?
No. What happens is once French fries start to cool down, then water basically exits the crystals, and that fluffy texture is lost. So the spheres become like more crystal-like, more gritty. And so that you can definitely taste the difference once the temperature of the French fry goes down.
And the water in those spheres has to go somewhere. So it leaks out, I assume, around the French fry?
Well, where does the water go? It leaves the soft inside of the fry, and it migrates into the crust. So not only do you have these fries where the internal texture is no longer as, you know, as poofy
and they don't
as light
good.
As it was, they don't smell good. You've also got a soggy crust. So for all of these reasons, that explains why cold fries are just no good at all.
Another sometimes disappointing food, store-bought tomatoes.
Oh, they taste like nothing. Yeah. Just these bags of water.
They really are, and they're sometimes hard. So anyone who's gone to the store to buy tomatoes knows that they leave a lot to be desired. Even if they look red and gorgeous, they don't taste good. And they're often missing the flavor, the juicy qualities of the tomatoes that you buy at a local produce stand. And so a team of scientists is actually aiming to bring the flavor back to tomatoes. And here joining us to talk about her research aimed at creating a flavorful tomato is Denise Thiemann. She is in the Horticultural Sciences Department at the University of Florida in Gainesville. Thanks so much for joining us, Denise.
Oh, no problem.
So when did you become interested in tomatoes or tomato flavors?
I worked on tomatoes pretty much my whole career, but I used to work on processing tomatoes. And then I had another project where I worked on tomato ripening in general. But about 15 years ago, we started this project on tomato flavor. And at the time, it was a small project in the lab, just trying things out. Now it's become pretty much everything we do in the lab is tomato flavor.
Was there a certain question you started out wanting to answer?
Because we're in Florida, we grow a lot of tomatoes. So it was an obvious choice for us. But the problem with Florida tomatoes is most of the varieties don't taste very good. Mostly because they bred them for shipping, for disease resistance, all these things you really need to have a modern commercial tomato. Uniform size is another thing that they're bred for. So all these things in the process of breeding for all these things, they've lost the flavor. So what we want to do is take a modern tomato and introduce good flavor back into it.
How do you actually figure out what gives tomatoes or the good tasting tomatoes their flavor?
It's been a long process for certain, and that's why we've been working on this for almost 15 years now. So what we started with is we really had to define what made a good tomato. So we started by looking at all the biochemistry of the flavor compounds. So that's mostly sugars and acids, and then the aroma compounds, the things that you smell that really give the tomato its unique flavor. So we quantified all those things using a lot of biochemistry. And then we actually asked people to taste these tomatoes. And then we tried to correlate biochemistry with flavor.
So I'm interested in, can you tell me a little bit more about the tasting? Did you have a bunch of people sitting in a room and you had them taste various tomato varieties to figure out which ones were the flavorful ones or the most flavorful ones? Give me a sense of how that worked.
Yeah, so yes, we do. We actually work with our food science and human nutrition department. They have a taste panel set up that they use for a lot of different things. And what we asked is about 100 people to come in to taste each variety of tomato. And they rated them on a lot of characteristics. First of all, obviously, how much they like them. And then sweet, sour, salty, bitter, all the, you know, the normal five senses that you have. And they rated them all those things. And then we used that data to correlate different attributes to the biochemistry of the tomato.
And what did you find?
Well, we found certain compounds that definitely contributed to flavor and some that detracted from flavor. So mostly, I mean, sugars and acids are important. You need that as the base for tomato flavor. So high sugar, there's a lot of people that just like a sweet tomato. But for a larger tomato, you're not going to have really high sugars because it takes too much energy for the plant to make that much sugar. So ideally, you have a balance of sugars and acids, and then you have these aroma compounds. We found certain aroma compounds that detracted from flavor, so you wanted less of those, but many that you wanted more of. And it's a balance of many compounds. And that's one of the unique things about tomatoes. Some fruits, like a banana, it's mostly one compound, and you smell that compound, and you say, well, that smells like a banana. But for tomato, it's a mix of many compounds. There's no one compound that's tomato flavor. So it makes it much more complex than some other fruits and vegetables.
So when I think about tomatoes, I definitely don't picture an odor or any sort of aroma. So I'm surprised at how important they seem to the tomato's taste.
But on the other hand, you know, if you tasted a tomato that really didn't have any flavor, you would say, oh, this is very bland. Even if it had the sugars and acids, if it didn't have the aroma compounds, you would say, well, it really doesn't taste like anything. And that's what a lot of the modern fruits and vegetables are. But if you go to a farmer's market or to a farm, grow your own, they taste very different than what you get in the store.
After you figure out which molecules give tomatoes their taste, sort of the chemistry of the flavor, how do you then figure out the genetics of all of that to create this tasty tomato?
We were lucky to be in the right place at the right time because now, just like you can send your own DNA and get it sequenced and they'll tell you who you're related to or whatever, we were lucky enough now that we can sequence the entire genome of many, many tomato varieties, and that's exactly what we did. So once we have the genetics, we have, you know, the actual sequence, DNA sequence of each tomato variety, then we can start using some really fancy statistics to show us which parts of the genome, the genes themselves, or pieces of the chromosomes that are important for different aroma compounds. And we can use that then to start breeding with molecular markers, which is a much easier way to do it than to actually phenotype every single tomato. Instead, you test the DNA. You say, oh, it's got this piece of chromosome 1. That means it'll be higher in one compound. So that's one that I want. So you can take many, many small plants way before they have fruit, genotype them all and say, I only want to grow up these few, which makes the whole growing of them, which is the expensive part, the difficult part, much easier.
So you're breeding the various tomatoes that give the tomatoes these genes. Is it sort of like making hybrids?
Yeah. So it's, yes. Yeah, so, we have to, basically what we're doing is we're taking several different genomic regions, so bits of chromosomes, from many different heirloom varieties that have the exact traits that we want, and putting them back into the modern Florida tomato. So it's quite a process because we have to do many crosses. So we take those. We looked at all the progeny from those crosses. We say, oh, I want this plant because it has exactly the pieces of DNA that I want. And that's the ones that will grow to maturity.
And you grow these in greenhouses at the lab?
Yeah, we have several greenhouses, and we also have a good deal of field space where we grow a lot of these. So this coming summer, we'll be planting many, many of these varieties, and we're going to actually have people taste them. So these are the ones where we've taken the modern Florida tomato and bred back in the flavor. And we're going to have people taste them this summer, so we're very excited.
Are there any tomatoes that you are most excited about that you think will be really good this year?
Well, you know, it's funny because we did do some stuff at the very beginning where we took a Florida variety and crossed it with an heirloom that had excellent flavor and just took the progeny of those. And we're actually selling those now as varieties that actually have good flavor and better yield, more disease resistance. So, you know, it's not maybe the absolute best it could be, but it's actually a pretty good tomato. So now we're just trying to make that better.
Okay, so one of the reasons that flavor has vanished from tomatoes has to do with this focused breeding for other traits like disease resistance and storability. When you guys add the flavor back in, will those traits go away and then will tomatoes lose the resistance and or the storability?
Only if it's in the same piece of the chromosome. So that's the idea, because breeding has been for flavor has been so difficult without these molecular markers. Now we should be able to do most of what we want to do, but we do need to keep the specific pieces of the chromosomes that are important for disease resistance, shipability, size, that kind of thing. So now, but now we can have molecular markers for all those things, so it makes our job much easier.
It's so interesting to think about how breeders were tasked with keeping tomatoes alive and in good shape when they were shipped, and they just didn't have this technology and ability to see how this would affect other traits in the tomato, like flavor, aromas, things like that.
Well, especially here in Florida, there's so many new diseases coming in all the time. The poor breeders were so busy just breeding for disease resistance, you know, especially with the older tools, not with the new tools that we have now, that's really all they had time for.
So who will plant the tomato seeds that will come up this summer?
Yes, yeah, so we're actually going to be planting the seeds this week, and we'll plant them in the field the middle of March, depending on the weather. In June will be all our big experiments. That's when we'll be really busy, really showing that we can actually do this, which is very exciting for us.
I look forward to seeing your tomatoes at the supermarket, Denise. I've been talking to Denise Thiemann of the Horticultural Sciences Department at the University of Florida in Gainesville. Denise, thanks so much for talking to us.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. We have more delicious eating and drinking mysteries to bring to the table. But first, we want to tell you about How It Works, the action-packed magazine bursting with exciting information about science and technology.
In How It Works, fascinating articles cover a wide range of topics with amazing illustrations and photos that bring science and technology to life. You'll learn something new every month, and it's great for all ages and for the whole family.
In the latest issue, How It Works explores the origin of humans, where we came from, and how we populated the world. So the first Homo sapiens populations originated in Africa, appearing about 300,000 years ago. And around that time, there were 9 known species in the human family tree.
So what differentiated modern humans from these other early humans?
Well, they had a lighter skeleton build. Humans had very large brains relative to their body size. They had a skull that was thin-walled with a high front and a flat and near-vertical forehead without that heavy brow ridge in front. The jaws were less heavily developed, and the teeth were smaller.
And when did migrations start out of Africa?
So modern humans first migrated north around 100,000 to 70,000 years ago, and then they spread into the Middle East and from there into Europe and Asia. Now, there is evidence that humans – definitely interacted with at least some of these extinct relatives, specifically Neanderthals. Until recently, it was thought that humans didn't encounter and intermingle and interbreed with Neanderthals until they left Africa. And so it was previously thought that people who were of non-African descent carried, 1 to 2% Neanderthal DNA. But there's a new study that shows that Neanderthal DNA is also in people of African descent. So it looks as though humans had encountered Neanderthals and were interbreeding with them before they even migrated out of Africa. And then once humans moved into Asia, they crossed into North America about 15,000 years ago, and they were able to do that over a land bridge in the Bering Strait. And that's a land bridge which is now submerged. And then from there, they reached South America about 1,000 years later. And there's still a lot that we don't know about the earliest Homo sapiens, and scientists are still piecing these clues together and trying to figure out how they lived and what their social lives and habits were. But scientists do know that having bigger brains helped our ancestors to survive while other ancient humans went extinct.
And it seems like it seems like we're just learning so much more about modern humans, early humans, and, every month, every week, there seems to be a new finding. Recently, Life Sciences' Laura Gagel wrote about an actual so-called ghost population of humans who lived in Africa.
So what does that mean? What is a ghost population?
Right. Well, so during the Stone Age in what is now Western Cameroon, four children died, and they were buried in a natural rock shelter. And so scientists found the remains, and they recently analyzed the DNA from the children's bones. So what they found was the children lived between 3,000 and 8,000 years ago. And so even though they lived thousands of years apart, they seem to be distant cousins. And I'm getting to the ghost population.
Okay.
So they looked at the DNA. They seemed to be distant cousins, and about one third of their DNA came from ancestors that are closely related to hunter-gatherers in where they were found in Western Central Africa. But the other two thirds of this DNA came from an ancient source in West Africa, and that included a long-lost ghost population of modern humans that scientists didn't know existed before. So they don't know who these people were. Right. So they're calling them this ghost population. And the children's genomes also showed various signs of admixture, is what scientists call it. And that suggests that their ancestors mated with people from different populations. Find out more about everyday mysteries of science and technology and how it works. Subscribe today to save over 80% and get 3 issues for just $3 or £3. Visit myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/how20 and search for How It Works.
Plus, exclusively for listeners of Life's Little Mysteries, you can get 2 free ebooks worth $40 when you subscribe. Get The Book of Dogs and Canines and the book Big Cats and African Wildlife delivered straight to your email, absolutely free. Just visit myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/how20 and search for How It Works.
You can also visit Live Science to read more about the ghost population of humans discovered in ancient Africa. So our next mystery is also about hot foods, but rather than temperature like in French fries, this food packs a different kind of heat.
We're talking about hot chili peppers.
Exactly. And not just any hot chili peppers. We're talking about some of the world's hottest peppers, specifically the Trinidad Moruga scorpion pepper. So it makes my body hurt just thinking about biting into this super hot pepper. But what would happen if you ate an entire pepper that was this hot? What would happen to your body? And that's our next mystery.
Well, how do we even know whether one pepper is hotter than another? Like how do scientists compare hotness in peppers?
So chili peppers have their own rating scale. It's called the Scoville scale, and it indicates the amount of capsaicin in the chili pepper. And capsaicin is the chemical that gives chili peppers their heat. It activates heat receptors in the nerve endings in your tongue, in your mouth, and it says this pepper is hot.
So where did the Scoville scale come from?
So Wilbur Scoville, he developed it, and he developed it in 1912. He was working at a pharmaceutical company, and he originally devised it with pepper extract, and he diluted it in sugar water. And he would have tasters. Usually there were five tasters, and they would taste the extract in the sugar water and how much sugar water he had to add to get it down to a zero, which was no heat. They'd say they didn't taste any heat. That ended up being zero on his scale. So a sweet pepper that has no capsaicin in it, it gets a Scoville rating of zero.
And then how high does the scale go?
So the hottest chilies like habaneros and like this Trinidad Moruga chili pepper, they can go up to 300,000 or more on this Scoville scale.
I hope his tasters were well compensated for the work that they did.
Well, yeah. And so one of the like weaknesses of the scale is that it is a little bit subjective because it's
right.
based on these tasters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what are some of these, you know, what are some of the hottest peppers?
The Trinidad Moruga scorpion pepper basically has a Scoville rating of 2 million or more. So this is really super hot, and apparently a scientist figured out that the heat that's packed in this pepper would be like eating 400 jalapenos.
Or drinking a shot glass full of pepper spray, which,
right.
which sounds so pleasant.
It sounds so awful. Why would anyone eat it?
I would never want to. And yet people eat hot peppers all the time. It's like they want to test themselves or something.
Exactly. And so if you actually ate an entire one of these peppers, and we do not recommend
no,
this.
No. But if you did, what would happen to you?
Okay, so our bodies are amazing. We have defenses for all kinds of things. And of course, if you were to put a spicy pepper, not the hottest spicy pepper, but just a spicy pepper into your mouth sort of goes numb because you have these receptors and they send a signal to your brain that, hey, this is pain. And your brain produces endorphins to help block that pain.
Oh, I see. So that's probably has something to do with why people like eating spicy peppers, because after the pain, you get this rush of endorphins.
Wow. I never thought of that. You're right.
So there you get it. So your brain is rewarding you for doing this incredibly painful thing.
And so with the Trinidad pepper, with the really hot peppers, that's not enough. Your brain can't block that pain because they're so hot.
So it's like it just basically overwhelms your brain.
Exactly. So your body has to step up its defenses, and there's a physiological thing that happens. You start to form these blisters underneath the top layer skin on your tongue and throat. And these are sort of like little cushions, and they help to absorb the heat of that chili pepper.
Oh, that does not sound like fun.
Yes. I mean, your body's essentially sacrificing a layer of cells to protect the rest of your body.
Okay, but does that protect your body from this terrible Trinidad pepper?
Nope.
Oh, no.
So the Trinidad's hot chemicals, they can penetrate through those
oh,
cushions,
God.
And they activate the heat receptors that are located below the pillows. And
then once they do that, then what happens?
Lots of burning sensations. And your mouth can burn for 20 minutes or more from eating one of these peppers.
Sometimes when I've eaten a hot pepper or when I've had hot sauce, you know, yes, if it's really hot, then you feel it in your mouth for a while. But I can't imagine 20 minutes of that burning sensation not going away.
No, and I mean, looking on YouTube and videos of people eating these hot peppers, I mean, you see people vomiting, you see people doing weird things like filling their mouth with Cheese Whiz or milk.
And why does that help?
So it actually does help. Dairy foods contain a protein called casein, and that protein neutralizes the capsaicin compounds. So they're doing something good, even though it looks weird.
Right. This is actually also a remedy if you've been pepper sprayed. You pour milk over your eyes, and that helps get rid of the burning sensation.
Oh, so the same mechanism there,
right? So okay, so it sounds like eating one of these Trinidad Moruga peppers would be a horrifically painful experience, but could it kill you?
Likely. Okay, so yes and no. I mean, likely you would pass out before getting to that point. But a study that was published in 1980, it found that about 2.7 pounds of one of these super hot peppers, like the Trinidad, could actually kill a 150-pound person.
So eating almost 3 pounds of these peppers. But actually, there was a recent report of a man who ate a ghost pepper in 2016 and ended up going to the hospital with a ruptured esophagus. So ghost peppers are among the hottest peppers. They're 1 million Scoville units, which is pretty hot. So apparently, eating just one seed will give you a 30-minute mouth burn for a ghost pepper. So what this man did was he
went to a restaurant and he had a special burger that they served, which had a ghost pepper pureed and spread on top of the burger. And then
why?
just because I don't know. He wanted that endorphin rush,
or, right? Right.
And then once he finished the burger, he drank six glasses of water really fast, and he just started retching and vomiting and would not stop retching.
Oh, God.
And so he ended up having to go to the hospital, and he had a torn esophagus and a collapsed lung. But the damage, it wasn't because the pepper like burned a hole in his throat. It was just from the prolonged vomiting. So, does not sound like a fun thing. And however much of an endorphin rush you may have gotten, I don't think
bad
it was
night.
Worth it.
Exactly. No. Apparently there are people with out those heat receptors, that tell your brain it's hot, it's painful, and that trigger all of this process of protecting your body. So they don't taste chili heat at all.
Oh, so they could eat the hottest peppers and they wouldn't even feel it.
Exactly.
Well, does that make them lucky?
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, so that chili pepper story kind of left a bad taste in my mouth, but it's not nearly as serious as what recently happened to a man in the UK, where a stuck piece of popcorn led to open-heart surgery. Joining us to talk about that is Live Science senior writer Rachel Rettner. Thanks so much for being here.
And thanks for having me.
Now, I've gotten popcorn stuck in my teeth many times, and it's really super annoying, but either it works its way out or it comes out with dental floss. What happened here? How did a stuck popcorn kernel send a man to the operating room?
So this was an unusual case. This was a case of a man in England who was doing what a lot of us do when we watch movies. He was eating popcorn, and that's when a kernel got stuck in his teeth, and it was really stubbornly stuck. It just wouldn't come out, no matter what he tried. And so this man got a little inventive, I guess you would say, and he tried to remove the husk with a variety of household items. So he actually prodded at his gums with a pen cap, a toothpick, a piece of wire, and even a metal nail. And he soon developed a toothache, but he didn't go to the dentist. And later he developed flu-like symptoms, including night sweats, fatigue, and headaches. That's when he went to the doctor because he thought he had the flu, but tests didn't show anything alarming. And yet he started to just feel worse and worse. And it would take more than a week before doctors finally realized what was wrong, and they diagnosed with endocarditis, which is an infection of the inner lining of the heart and the heart valve. But by the time he got his diagnosis, his heart valves were so damaged from the infection that he needed a 7-hour operation to replace and repair his heart valves. And going back to how this happened, endocarditis happens when bacteria enter the bloodstream and spread to the heart. And one way that bacteria can enter the bloodstream is even through everyday oral activities that cause the gums to bleed, so even something like brushing your teeth too hard. But in this case, the man said the only thing he could think of that caused this infection was just poking at his gums with these random items to try and remove the popcorn husk.
In the article, you mentioned that one of the clues that told doctors that the man was in trouble was something called Janeway lesions. What are those, and how do they show that something serious might be happening in the body?
So one clue that this man had endocarditis was that he developed a lesion on his foot called a Janeway lesion. And these are red or purple tender spots that can develop on the palms of the hands or the soles of the feet. And they're really a marker of endocarditis. They're thought to be caused by infected blood clots that travel from the heart to these other parts of the body. So when doctors saw that this man had this red spot on his foot, it was really a factor that allowed them to determine that he had endocarditis.
And what makes endocarditis such a dangerous infection?
So endocarditis is dangerous because it can seriously damage or even destroy heart valves, which can prevent the heart from working properly. And in addition to that, the infection in the heart can form these clumps of bacteria and cell material. And these clumps can then break loose from the heart and travel to other parts of the body, including the brain, the lungs, and the kidneys. So they can cause these serious complications like stroke or blockage of lung arteries or kidney damage.
How do doctors treat endocarditis?
So fortunately, often endocarditis can be treated with just antibiotics to kill the bacteria. And these antibiotics are given through an IV for as long as 6 weeks to rid the body of the infection.
But if the infection isn't caught early, then patients, they already have damage to their heart valve. And in these cases, surgery is needed to repair or replace the damaged valves. And so this was the case for the man in England, since it had been several weeks before his infection was discovered. His heart valves were very damaged and he needed heart surgery.
All right. So this is clearly a very extreme example, but is there other evidence that there's a link between oral health and a healthy heart?
Yeah, there are actually a lot of studies that link gum disease with an increased risk of heart disease, heart attack, and stroke. And the reason for this link isn't clear, but it's thought that gum disease may increase inflammation in the body, which in turn increases the risk for heart disease. I'm still unclear, though, if gum disease in general is a direct cause of heart disease. But for endocarditis, the link is more clear-cut, and we know that endocarditis is caused by bacteria getting into the bloodstream. So good oral health is one step people can take to prevent endocarditis. But it's important to note that with bacterial endocarditis, like this is the man in England, it's an uncommon condition overall. So in most people, when bacteria get into your bloodstream, the immune system kills the bacteria, and the bacteria do make it to your heart, they can pass through without a problem. But in some people, particularly people with defects in the heart valve or artificial heart valve, the bacteria can settle there in the heart valve and cause the infection. So good oral health is really important for everyone, and especially important for people with risk factors for endocarditis.
Did the man in England learn his lesson about proper handling of stuck popcorn?
The man actually swore off eating popcorn altogether. And he says that if he thinks if he has just gone to the dentist, his whole ordeal could have been prevented.
And I am also now having second thoughts about eating popcorn ever again. You can check out Rachel Rettner's article, How a Piece of Popcorn Stuck in a Man's Teeth Led to Open Heart Surgery, on Live Science. The link is in the show notes. Rachel, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks. Bye.
For today's final mystery, we're going to look at something that's a common food for many animals, though it's somewhat less common for humans, and that's blood. Some of the animals that have a diet that is mostly or exclusively made of blood are animals like mosquitoes, ticks, fleas, leeches. There are birds like the vampire finch and the oxpecker, and then, of course, vampire bats. And for centuries, people have been fascinated by popular vampire stories of, you know, plays and movies and books. And part of that fascination is the idea of subsisting on human blood.
Right. So can drinking human blood actually harm you?
Well, that's the subject of today's last mystery. Is it safe for people to drink blood?
Is it universally bad to drink blood? Is it something that nobody should do?
Well, no. Actually, blood drinking or eating congealed blood, you know, usually combined with some kind of meat, is something that's very common in cultures around the world. This is animal blood. This is not human blood.
Right. Okay.
Yes. But humans cannot survive on blood alone. And there's definitely a risk that comes along with drinking or eating blood because of blood-borne diseases such as hepatitis B or hepatitis C or HIV.
Right, which are carried in the blood, and then if they get into your body and into your bloodstream, can cause disease.
Then there's a risk of infection, right. So drinking human blood is something that
carries a lot of risk.
Carries a lot of risk and is not recommended. But blood is also so iron-rich that it can even be toxic. So iron in excessive amounts in people can lead to a condition called hemochromatosis.
And so what is hemochromatosis?
Well, this can actually cause a wide variety of problems. So it's a buildup of iron that can lead to dehydration, low blood pressure, liver damage, a buildup of fluid in the lungs, and even disorders of the nervous system.
So if blood is so risky, how do animals basically survive on it exclusively, just drinking blood?
Well, that's because these animals have special adaptations for not only blood drinking, but for digesting it as well. So they have special mouth parts, and there's chemistry and structures within their bodies that help them to process blood safely. So, for example, leeches have this anticoagulant saliva. Ticks and bed bugs have anticoagulants too. And basically what this does is once they latch on and they start feeding, this keeps the blood from clotting. So it keeps it flowing so, you know, that it's nice and smooth for them. I mean, you've probably noticed that, you know, when you notice that a mosquito has bitten you, it's usually too late.
It's already filled
its belly. You notice the bite. Yes, you notice the bite, but you know, but the mosquito is long gone. And so that's because when they actually insert their proboscis in your skin, so you know, as it goes in, there is also just like a little bit of this anesthetic that goes in there too, so that you don't actually feel. So you know, imagine if you were getting a shot and you were getting a little bit of anesthetic at the same time, so you didn't actually feel the needle going in. That's what's happening with the mosquito. So by the time you notice that something has landed on you and was drinking your blood, it's too late and they're already gone.
How do their bodies handle the blood after they've drank it? What happens?
Right. So for animals that rely on blood as the main part of their diet, they have highly specialized digestive mechanisms that help them to process and extract nutrients from it. So, for example, vampire bats, they actually need a lot of iron in their diet. It helps them to make hemoglobin for carrying oxygen from their lungs to their body tissues. But even for vampire bats, the iron intake from blood is usually more than they can use. So they have a special process for getting rid of the extra iron. So after they swallow blood, it goes through an intestinal tract where nutrients are extracted, and then a special mucous membrane acts as a barrier that prevents too much iron from entering their bloodstream.
So they were really just sort of evolved and built to drink blood.
Right. And there's a reason why so many animals have adapted to drink blood. It's very nutritious, very high in protein. It has vitamins and minerals, and it's actually lower in cholesterol than eggs. This is why in many cultures, in many parts of the world, blood is a staple in many diets. There are many human foods around the world that incorporate animal blood.
So there's, in Asia and Scandinavia, there are actual blood soups and stews.
And there, and I know I have had firsthand personal experience with blood sausages in Germany. Blood sausages, which they're also found in other parts of the world. That's where animal blood is cooked with a filler like meat or fat or bread or rice until it's thick enough to congeal into a sausage-like shape when it's cooled.
And how does it taste?
It was really interesting. It's a very, it's very heavy. So I had this for the first time when I was in Germany a few years ago, and I'd never had a blood sausage before, and this was very fresh. it was very fresh. My plate looked like something out of a horror movie when I was done. And then my body's like, okay, I need to take a break for a little while now and just process this. So it was very tasty, but it was definitely a very heavy meal. So, but there are other blood dishes that are on the lighter side,
right.
such as these pancakes. These pancakes called blodplätters, which are found in Finland and Sweden, and these are made of whipped blood that's fried very thin and very crisp.
Right, and they actually look sort of like pancakes, but dark, kind of a dark maroon red.
I haven't seen
them in person.
Bloody pancakes, yes.
Photos of them. And people around the world also eat solidified forms of blood. In China, there's actual blood tofu. It's congealed and it's cut into squares like mm-hmm. tofu.
Yep. And then in Tibet, there's a dish that's made with congealed yak blood. There's a curd of pig blood, which is eaten in Vietnam and Korea. Blood is fried with onions in Hungary. And so all of these different ways that blood can be prepared in a solid or in a semi-solid way, and then mixed with different foods is a good way to get a good source of protein.
Right, and low in cholesterol. And mm-hmm. drinking animal blood is, you know, some cultures actually do drink blood. In the Maasai in Kenya and Tanzania and northern Tanzania, they drink cattle blood as part of their traditional Maasai diet.
Right. Their diet is almost exclusively meat and animal products and blood.
And on the sweeter side.
On the sweeter side, there was actually a blood chocolate bar that was hugely popular in the Soviet Union for decades. It was called Hematogen.
What a name.
Yeah, and it was made of 5% cow's blood. And so, and this was a, it was.
And people ate this.
People ate this all the time. This was a nutrition bar, and it was kind of hyped as something that was for treating anemia. And I guess, and I think it was not really widely understood that it contained actual blood. But yeah, it absolutely did. So whether you're a mosquito lapping blood out of somebody's arm or sitting down to a plate of whipped blood pancakes, blood can be a nutritious and unexpectedly sometimes delicious meal.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. All of today's eating and drinking mysteries. Why do French fries taste so bad when they're cold? What if you eat an entire Trinidad Moruga Scorpion Chili Pepper? And is it safe to drink blood? Are available as Life's Little Mysteries articles on our website, livescience.com. You can also find out more about these mysteries in this podcast's notes.
Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our live science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally. It'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audioboom as part of their Audioboom Originals Network.